Welcome to the Muscle Expert Podcast with Ben Pakulski, one of the world's top professional bodybuilders, an expert on human performance and mindset mastery. Ben dives deep to deliver the strategies of the top experts to upgrade your body, mind, muscle, strength, performance, biochemistry, and how to become the upgraded modern man. Join us on BenPakulski.com to learn the cutting-edge techniques to take control of your body, your brain, and create your greatest life.
What's up, everybody? Ben Pakulski, the Muscle Expert Podcast, and today's guest is Jeremy Linicki from the University of Mississippi. And how do you know that name? Jeremy is the leading researcher in the world right now on blood flow restriction training, and he's going to tell us everything there is to know about blood flow, who should be using it, what are the applications, and obviously who should not be using it, as well as some other amazing insights into how to optimize your training, particularly around strength training. If you want to get strong, you're probably doing a lot of things wrong, and Jeremy's going to give us some insights into what those are, including how much volume is necessary, and maybe what we don't understand about hypertrophy. And we have some assumptions around things that happen or things that are associated with building muscle and hypertrophy mechanisms. And Jeremy is going to dispel some of those myths in today's episode. So I hope you love it. Enjoy it. If you do love it, please share it and leave us a review. Enjoy the episode. Hey, Jeremy, how you doing, man?
Good, man. How you doing?
I'm doing excellent. Yeah, so I'm so grateful, man. I'm pumped about this because you're the guy doing the good research these days, it seems.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, there's some I don't know about questionable research, but there's people that are staying within the paradigm of their belief system, and you're the guy who's challenging the paradigm of the belief system, and I think that's why what you're doing is so special.
I appreciate that. We're trying to.
Yeah, man. Well, you definitely are. I mean, you know, everybody's asking the same questions and getting the same results that I believe are ignorant, and you're the guy stepping outside the box, man. So tell me what you're – I think I have a pretty good idea of what you're researching right now, but tell me about what you're researching, man, and what's most exciting for you right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're always doing blood flow restriction stuff. Mm-hmm. We'll always be doing that. But I think, you know, one of our newer ideas that we're interested in is this muscle size and strength.
Yeah.
And, you know, how much of a role does the change in muscle size play with the change in muscle strength?
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that's a big part of our focus. And, you know, that alongside just kind of questioning some of the other kind of foundations of periodization, general adaptation syndrome, and just kind of at least trying to draw some pause and going like, you know, is this something really that really has a tremendous amount of evidence behind it, you know? So
man, tell me about that, because I read your stuff on the GAS, you know, the Hans Selye stuff. Tell me about how, like, most people aren't going to understand what that means. So tell me about what that looks like and what you're trying to challenge as far as the adaptations and thoughts around GAS.
Yeah, well, we were, I guess a couple of years ago, we were asked to write a paper on periodization.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were going through that literature, we started to realize that, you know, there's just not a lot of evidence that suggests that periodization is inherently superior to just progressive overload.
Yep.
And when we were getting ready to submit it, one of my students was like, you know, it seems like one of the foundational arguments behind this is the general adaptation syndrome. He's like, maybe we should read some of those early papers and see.
Mm-hmm.
So we go back and look at it, and well, he did, and then he comes back in the next day. He's like, you might want to take a look at this. So we look through it, and it's like this is a giant leap to say that this the work of Hans Selye is in any way reflective of exercise when people lift weights in the gym. So I think it's been an enormous leap to say that general adaptation syndrome, because if you go back and look at those papers, what they're doing is, you know, they're doing kind of different doses of drugs, and they look at the change in the thymus. So does the thymus gland, does it increase or does it decrease? And to me, I don't think that it has any relevance to lifting weights.
Right.
So that's really kind of what led us there. And, you know, we've just been kind of going back and forth in the literature with that, because obviously that's a minority opinion.
So obviously when you refer to periodization, there's many different types. And so what specific ones are you referring to when you say you're kind of comparing it against progressive overload?
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing that they'll always, one of the things we're running into now is, well, when you guys talk about, you guys aren't really talking about periodization, you're talking about programming. And, you know, my retort is, you know, look, it's just, that's, we're just getting down to semantics at this point. When I talk about periodization, I'm talking about the papers in the literature which are used for evidence for periodization, linear periodization, nonlinear. And really what we're not saying that, you know, periodization doesn't work in the sense of, do you get bigger and stronger? Of course. Those are adaptations to lifting weights. But one of the things that's, there's three claims that are made, the first one being that it's superior to progressive overload for muscle hypertrophy, that it's superior for muscle strength, and that it prevents overtraining. And those three things don't have a tremendous amount of evidence behind it. The strength one is largely explained by the principle of specificity, at least it seems like to us. And the other, the periodization or the muscle hypertrophy one has really no evidence behind it to show that it's superior. And then the overtraining one also has really no evidence behind it at all.
Interesting, man. So one of the approaches we take here, Jeremy, and you probably aren't completely not familiar with this, but we basically look at the body as having three primary types of internal stimuli, right? You have a neurological stimulus, you have a hypertrophy-based stimulus, and you have a metabolic-based stimulus. And the way that we progress, or the way that I progress with my clients, is, you know, I look at it like volume dials, and I'll have one of them turned kind of all the way up, and the other two are kind of turned down. And then as we challenge that one, it gets your threshold to achieve the desired internal stimulus goes up and up and up and up, thereby creating more internal stress. So there's more stress associated with this massive amount of work that's necessary to achieve this small amount of progression. So what I'll do then is I'll turn a different one up and bring this one down. So I'm deloading one while I'm turning another one up. But obviously you could have a couple of them, different variations of how much of each volume knob is turned up. But the idea is we're always kind of deloading at least one of them while we're training at least one or two of them, and then thereby always having one type of stimuli that that has a very low threshold to achieve a stimulus. So, you know, for example, if you're a predominant strength trainer, you may have a pretty low capacity for, or a pretty low threshold for, a metabolic oxidative type stimulus. So thereby just a small amount of stimulus can get you a tremendous amount of results. And I basically just fluctuate each of those within, you know, a training block, with the objective of keeping the internal stressors as low as possible. Because ultimately we know that if your internal stress is high, your inflammation is high, your cortisol is left elevated, you're not going to progress as quickly, your body's not going to recover as fast. So that's the way I view periodization, right? And looking at it like that, do you have any opinions on, you know, how much internal stress and inflammation can actually influence the progress of someone in their periodization?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one when you're manipulating all these things at once. Mm-hmm. I think ultimately, my opinion is that I don't think that training needs to be that complicated, just in general. And I think that what you describe, I think, is where you, when you increase one stimulus, you want to decrease another. To me, that makes a tremendous amount of sense. You know, that's kind of like a overall rest. So, you know, we're not arguing against rest. Mm-hmm. But I do think that, you know, as kind of you described, if you want to get a little bit better at this, you need to spend some time training in that. Mm-hmm. So if you want to get better at multiple things, yeah, you have to, programming becomes a little bit more complicated because you have to train multiple things, no question. But yeah, I think that the rest makes, you know, having resting one system and training another one, to me that makes sense. And I think when you're programming for a person, you know, and you have to make changes in real life, you know, I think it's a little bit different than an experiment. So, you know, it's never going to line up 100%.
So one of the studies that's been brought to my attention that you're doing is looking at the influence on volume on strength accumulation, and tissue accumulation, I'm guessing. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the one of our big criticisms of the muscle hypertrophy literature, meaning the literature used to describe why people get stronger, is they'll train people and they increase muscle size and they increase strength. Mm-hmm. And what they'll conclude is, well, then muscle size must be contributing to strength. If they have another group that just increases strength but no change in muscle size, they go, well, it must be neural. But the study wasn't actually designed to answer the question. So one of the things that we did was we just created a model where, you know, we don't stimulate growth at all, where we just have people come in and do the strength test. So obviously that maximizes the strength response and minimizes the growth response. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other group, we do traditional exercise, which is going to be a lot of, you know, a decent amount of volume, especially relative to a group doing only the 1RM. Mm-hmm. And they get, you know, obviously they have volume, so they get increases in muscle size, they get increases in strength. Now, at the end of the study, the strength is the same, despite the fact that one group saw muscle hypertrophy and one group didn't. Mm-hmm. So I think that some degree of volume is, I don't think anybody disagrees that some degree of volume is very important for muscle hypertrophy. Now, with strength, I think it becomes a lot less important. I think it becomes more so coming down to the strength test, and particularly, you know, it becomes even more important the more complex the movement gets. You know, doing a leg extension or a bicep curl is not that difficult. Doing a squat is much more complex, which means to me, my hypothesis would be that that specificity becomes even more important when trying to get a big 1RM in the squat. Now, people have taken that to mean that, well, all he recommends is just doing 1RM training. And, you know, I do that myself for the deadlift because I it's fun for me and it makes me enjoy going to the gym. But mm-hmm. I think the point more so is that you should be training near to what you actually want to be improving. If you want to increase muscle size and strength, yeah, you're going to have to be doing more than just doing singles. But if all your goal is just having a big 1RM, then you should probably spend a majority of your time training near the 1RM. That's really our point. The reason why we use those designs is because we're able to really see big increases in strength with no growth, which in science is we're trying to control variables. And that's sure. We're one of the few people who have used the design where we're able to do that.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, I mean, I work with a lot of athletes and the idea is how fast and strong can you get these guys without adding any muscle because they want to stay as light and agile as possible. So that's a huge discovery point for us is like, you know, how can you add 50 pounds to this guy's bench press, deadlift, and squat and add zero muscle? So I love that you're doing that research because it's absolutely applicable to, you know, with everyone doing MMA fighting these days and everyone being some degree of athlete, it's useful.
Yeah.
So the one question I wanted to ask you, man, is you know, I'm a hypertrophy guy, and I think there's tons of misinformation around hypertrophy training and what's necessary. So if we could walk down the path of, you know, what are the mechanisms we know and what don't we know about, or what do we know about the mechanisms of hypertrophy? And then conversely, what don't we know? Because I think we make a lot of assumptions in the way that we train and going, oh, I'm training this type of stimulus for hypertrophy, but we make a lot of assumptions in there. So I'd love for you to just talk about, you know, the mechanisms of hypertrophy, what we do know, and then where the gaps are.
Yeah, I think the mechanisms of muscle hypertrophy, I think that's an interesting question. I think that hypertrophy has been one of our main goals for a long time. It's one of the things that's interested me the most. I think that generally people try and if we think about just the training variable, obviously you need some volume to see growth. I don't think it needs to be astronomical amount of volume, but you need some duration component of the contraction to start these cascades. Mm-hmm. Now, just the three broad categories that I think people commonly discuss, and I think probably Brad Schoenfeld has probably popularized this the most, but kind of this mechanical component, this mm-hmm. metabolic component, and muscle damage. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, I never really put a lot of stock in the muscle damage component. I just don't see any rationale behind that. So that always left us with the metabolic as well as the mechanical, at least kind of mechanistic components to how muscle grows. Mm-hmm. Now, I, for a long time, thought that there was something really unique about the pooling of metabolites. And a lot of that came from our blood flow restriction literature.
Yeah.
Our blood flow restriction work, meaning that, you know, we're pooling a lot of these metabolites inside the limb. And for a long time, I thought that this was pretty important for muscle hypertrophy, independent of the mechanical stimulus. And I no longer really think that, just because, you know, I at some point I had to just kind of bring myself to question, you know, is there really actual evidence behind that, that the metabolites in and of themselves are anabolic? And a lot of that came from my students just kind of repeatedly calling me out on it. It's like, well, you know, where is the evidence for this? So I think one of the big triggers for muscle hypertrophy is the mechanical, obviously. Now, if you want to talk about the molecular cascade behind that, I don't think anybody knows that. I think they think it seems like it's a local response, meaning that something inside the muscle is sensing tension mm-hmm. and it's starting a cascade. It doesn't appear to be modulated to any large degree by changes or by acute changes in systemic hormones or anything like that. And with the metabolic component, one of the things that we think is with low load exercise, we think those metabolites kind of expedite fatigue and cause an increase in the mechanical. So we do think that they're related, but we don't think that there's anything inherently special per se about the pooling of metabolites, other than the fact that they help augment mechanical activation at very low loads.
Interesting. So it seems as though the greatest contribution or the greatest correlate is going to be mechanical tension.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that you have to have, again, some degree of volume of that mechanical tension.
Sure.
You have to accumulate a sufficient amount of that within an exercise session to kind of stimulate that growth cascade. And I don't think it's a lot, but I do think that there is pretty good evidence that volume is pretty important for that.
So has your opinion changed on blood flow restriction training?
In what way?
Well, you're saying you don't believe the metabolites are quite as important. So tell me what your current opinion is, your current stance, or what you've learned and what you've evolved to learn with blood flow restriction.
Yeah, I think that the metabolites are still important with blood flow restriction in the sense that they augment the mechanical.
Okay, right? Got you. Understood.
So they add to the mechanical activation where when you lift a heavy weight, you already are lifting, you're already getting a lot of recruitment. Whereas when you lift a lightweight, you don't really need a lot of recruitment right out of the gates. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you pull metabolites, you can kind of expedite that process. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of my thought there. Now, some people will point to, and I still wrestle with this myself. There is some evidence that when you apply blood flow restriction, independent of any muscle contraction, meaning that there's a few studies that show in people with surgery or people who are immobilized that when you restrict blood flow with no muscle contraction, that it's able to maintain strength and attenuate losses in muscle size, meaning that you still lose muscle, but you have more than you would have had.
Yep.
Now, what is the mechanism behind that? And I don't know, maybe there's different mechanisms with the atrophy than there is on the hypertrophy. I don't really know. My hunch would be, and what I've talked about before, is that there might be something to this cell swelling, cell volumization, that maybe there is something to pulling this fluid inside the limb. I think that there might be something to that. But I think it's also reasonable to suggest that, you know, there's only a few of those studies.
Mm-hmm.
There may be, I mean, it's possible that there could be some publication bias there, meaning that there could have been a handful of studies that have done it and shown nothing. So I'm very cautious when I interpret that literature, because there's just not a lot of it. When we talk about resistance exercise and blood flow restriction, there's a tremendous amount.
Right.
But the blood flow restriction in and of itself, while I would like to think that it's beneficial, and it's because that would be huge for people if it was real, and it might very well be, but there's just not a lot to it. And I don't really have an explanation other than maybe these acute changes in cell swelling might be important.
Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind is maybe it's just some type of acute hormetic stress, and your body senses a stressor, sends some type of anabolic hormone response, or, you know, some type of internal response that maybe contributes to less muscle loss. It's interesting, though. Definitely worth researching.
Yeah, for sure.
What are the biggest myths that people are portraying? Because, you know, you've my observation of you, and don't take this the wrong way, has been a whistleblower, man. You're the guy who's calling people on their shit. And I'm that guy too, man, because like I think everybody's so full of shit and up their own butt that they're willing to just spout out about all this great research that they're doing. And a lot of it's kind of not all that exciting, or people are very attached to, you know, their way. And you're like, well, what about that way? What about that way? They all work. So, you know, going down that question, what are the biggest myths that come to mind, you know, as far as things that have been kind of identified in research or things that people are doing in strength and hypertrophy training?
Huh. Yeah, that's a good question. I think that, you know, I guess the one that I always fall back to, because it's always on my mind right now, is that there's, at the very least, that muscle hypertrophy, that the change in muscle size with training is a kind of at the forefront of what you should be doing if you want to increase muscle strength. You know, again, we're in the minority there for sure, but at the very least, you have a lot of people who are going, well, you're ignoring a lot of the literature. You're ignoring a lot of the literature. And me and my students, you know, to be honest, we spent a lot of time on this and we continue to do so. And one night in particular, we went through over 60 textbooks because we would, you know, our kind of idea was, well, they keep saying we were missing something, right? So the textbooks must have the best available evidence. So we went back, we had textbooks from 2017 and we had every decade back into the 1930s.
Wow.
Because we wanted to see why do people think this? I totally understand why people think this, because they've been taught it. It seems intuitive to them. Mm-hmm. But my question was, why does it seem so intuitive? Where did it come from? So if you look back in 1930s, Snyder was one of the first exercise phys textbooks, and he says that it's pretty obvious that there's a disconnect between the change in muscle strength and the change in muscle size. That's obvious to everyone even today, that people get a lot more stronger than they change in muscle size with training.
Mm-hmm.
There's a dissociation there. And then you get to Rosh and Morehouse, and those are big specificity guys back in the day. And what they suggested was that there's no good evidence that muscle hypertrophy is really changing strength here. It may just be a byproduct of training. And they thought that it might not even be a good byproduct. Now, then you get into the 80s. And what happens is you have a shift from people going, is muscle hypertrophy important? What's it doing? To muscle hypertrophy is important. And it's essential. So what changed? And what we found is what changed is a study by Moratani and DeVries, where they had a study where they had a group of people, they trained one arm, they did bicep curls, the other arm didn't train, okay? And they saw a change in voltage. And that was, to them, indication that muscle hypertrophy was important. So they didn't even measure muscle hypertrophy. And that's the study that really changed it. And then Digby Sale wrote a review paper. And he was discussing this paper, and he said, look, he just hypothesized this figure where it shows like the first 8 weeks you have neural then hypertrophy. He was just hypothesizing, and that became the gold standard, right? That it's neural first and then it's hypertrophy. And the reason why we don't see these in the literature is because the studies aren't long enough to show them. But the fact of the matter is that the study, the reason why people think this in the first place was an 8-week study. So my question is, why is a study which we have done, 8 weeks in duration, which was designed to actually answer the question, why is that not of sufficient duration to at least challenge this idea? But a study that wasn't designed to answer the question at all, who didn't measure muscle hypertrophy at all, why is that long enough to establish this? So a lot of people back that up and go, yeah, but if you look at the correlations of the changes in muscle size with the changes in muscle strength, the problem is that, as many people know, you can't infer cause and effect with a correlation. But that's not even – and that's fine. That's true. Everybody knows that. But the second point is that I think we should be very cautious when we are interpreting correlations in muscle size and strength, because what they'll do is they'll retrospectively go back to studies where they've design programs to increase muscle size and increase strength. The programs were designed to increase both. There's no, it of course makes sense that they would be correlated if both of them were designed to increase.
Right.
Now, if you go to our studies and you run a within subject correlation on the hypertrophy group, the one that saw volume, had high increases in volume, saw increases in muscle size and strength. If we run the correlation on that group, it's very high.
Sure.
Right? And that's the only group that's included in these other studies. But our study, if you remember, was unique in the fact that we had another group designed to eliminate growth but maximize strength.
Yep.
And when we run the within subject correlation on that, there is no relationship. Right? So I agree that there's a relationship when you have a program that increases muscle size and strength, but that doesn't get at answering the question that people are interested in. And the other point is that when you're looking at correlations of the change in muscle size and the change in muscle strength, what happens is you run a regression line on that. And what that assumes is that people are changing differently to exercise. And everybody knows that people are changing differently, but you can't detect that in most of our training studies because the error associated with each measurement is compounded. So they're fitting a regression line, assuming that people are responding differently, but we can't actually know that for sure. So despite the fact that you can't do cause and effect, despite the fact that the study designed to actually answer this question doesn't show a relationship, and the last point being that most of these correlational studies are just correlating error with error, there's just no good evidence for it.
Sure.
And I'll just end. I know I kind of went on a rant there.
No, it's great.
I'll end with this point here, because a lot of people have criticized our two studies that were done to answer this question. And some of them are right. You know, those are fair criticisms. Of course, there's no study that's perfect, right? But what I always go back to is that our studies were designed to answer this question, and they show no cause of muscle hypertrophy. Now, if you at the very least, if you don't like those studies, right, that's fine. Just remove them off the table. Right. Just pretend they never existed. And what are we left with? We're left with nothing. We're still left with no evidence that the change in muscle size with training contributes to the change in muscle strength with training. It just doesn't exist.
How long was your study, Jeremy?
Our first one we did, we really kind of came across it by accident. We were really interested in something else. We did everyday training for 3 weeks. Now, the second one that we actually designed to really do it was 8 weeks. So the same duration as more Italian DeVries.
So the reason I ask is, you know, the first thing that comes to mind as to what may be the most correlated variable is simple biomechanics, right? So if you give somebody a greater internal biomechanical leverage, biomechanical lever by seeing hypertrophy in the muscle, to me, that's going to make a pretty big difference. Has anybody researched that?
Yeah, my guess is that if we talk about kind of a biomechanical change from the muscle size as an adult lifting weights, I don't know that it would change enough to really have a big influence. But I'm not a biomechanist.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the biomechanics, meaning that I just think that the biomechanics inherent to the individual at baseline are really going to be play a big role, you know, meaning that you're going to be better at certain lifts. Now, changing muscle size to impact that, I don't know that it would change enough to do that, to be honest.
But it would definitely be a time thing, right? It's not going to happen in 3 weeks or 8 weeks. It would definitely be like, okay, how much this is going to take a long time for your mechanics to actually change, because you'd have to see a substantial amount of hypertrophy to change the mechanics of that muscle.
Yeah, and I guess I would argue that I think as an adult, who's just lifting weights from just resistance exercise alone,
mm-hmm.
Kind of exogenous support. I think that some people probably do increase muscle size quite a bit, mm-hmm. but my guess is that, you know, I always try to kind of tie it back into that acute hormonal response.
Sure.
Meaning that, I will wrap this point up to where it hopefully makes sense, but kind of the way that I try to discuss this and try to think about it for myself is, you know, not so long ago, it was really thought that these acute changes in hormones were very, very important. And my first paper, I wrote about that, right? These acute changes in hormones are very important for muscle hypertrophy. Stu Phillips comes along and says, not so fast. And I remember sitting in those lectures, I'm like, what is this guy talking about? I don't get what this guy's talking about. How could these changes in hormones not be influencing muscle size? This guy's crazy. And then he would come out with paper after paper, and I'm just like, what is this guy talking about? Because I'm like, I know people on drugs who have an enormous amount of change in muscle size and strength. Mm-hmm. And his point was is that the change that you see from exercise is so small that it doesn't get anywhere close, and it doesn't sustain the duration that you get from taking drugs. And I'm like, okay, so the acute and chronic thing, that makes sense. So to bringing it back to muscle size, could if muscle size increased enough, could it play a role? Probably, for sure. But does it? I just don't think it does in an adult lifting weights. Now, when you talk about it, it's hard for many of us who've been lifting our whole lives where we go, but what is this guy talking about? You know, the change in muscle size. I remember where I started, but many of us started when we were young. So the change that you see from development is much greater than the change that you see from lifting weights, in my opinion. So I think that, yeah, I think if muscle size, when an adult undergoes lifting weights, the increase in muscle size that they get, I think it could play a role if it increased enough, but it just doesn't most right. of the time.
Understood. Yeah. I mean, that's a fair point, man. It's definitely something that I think needs to be considered more in research, though, because there's a lot of research that I'm not going to throw under the bus, but a lot of research out there that says, hey, this is correlated with this. And you look at it, it's complete rubbish, as you know, because they're not looking at biomechanics. And I think biomechanics from person to, you know, the research I'm referring to is like, hey, this exercise is better than that exercise for pecs, or this one's better than this one for glutes, or whatever it is. It's ludicrous. It's complete bullshit because unless you're looking at individual mechanics person to person, you can't make those deductive reasonings, those deductive assumptions. Hey guys, so this podcast is brought to you by me, the MI40 Nation. So each of you is obviously at some level interested in muscle building. And for the last 20 years, I've been going deep on mastering this process. And I've narrowed it down to a very few key principles that absolutely must be foundational in everyone's program in order to get maximum results. So over the last 3 years at the MI40 gym in Tampa, my team and I have been diving deep on, you know, what are those little foundational principles that everyone should be applying to maximize their ability to build muscle. And obviously by building muscle, we're going to optimize our ability to lose fat. So this week we are launching a brand new program called Hypertrophy Execution Masterclass. And if you guys are interested in building muscle in the fastest way possible with the least amount of inefficiencies and injuries, then this is an absolute must for you. So I hope you guys love today's episode, and I look forward to seeing you all in the MI40 Nation with Hypertrophy Execution Masterclass. And if you want to learn more about that, you can go to hypertrophymastery.com. One thing I want to ask you about is what has been the most surprising or encouraging research that you've come across anywhere in the last couple of years? What are you excited about for the next 10 years?
Surprising or encouraging? That's a good question. Obviously, I'm always biased to what we do, so I'm going to try and think of something that we don't do. Because I'm always going to go back to, the first thing that always intrigued me was blood flow restriction. Mm-hmm. So we spent a lot of time doing that, and we still do that. One of the things that I think is interesting with that is it's moving more into the clinical settings where I think it has a huge role. The muscle size and strength thing, the periodization. But what excites me? I think one of the things is these individual responders. And this is another thing that I think was not intuitive to me at all. And you'll hear me talk about it a lot. I always say my students. And what I'm referring to is the students in my lab, mm-hmm. who are just absolutely amazing. And to sit around and talk science with these guys all day is awesome. And one of them in particular, he's kind of, we're all kind of interested in this individual response. And a lot of it, when we talk about looking at the literature and we go, look at these individual people who change differently. To me, I would look at that and I'd go, man, this one person, if everybody else is going increasing, this person's decreasing. what's happening with what's going on with that person? And some of my students who are a little bit more up on statistics and mathematics than I am would go, well, that's error. We don't know that that person is really changing differently than someone else. And I think that one of my interests in the near future is to look at, can we actually determine if people are changing differently to exercise, right? So one of the things that, and your listeners are going to be like, what the hell is this guy talking about? We all know this, right? And it's true. We all do know that people change differently to exercise. Some people gain a lot more muscle mass than others. But the difference is, can we detect it with the equipment that we have?
Right.
And can we actually determine that people, that if you gain 10 pounds, that you gain more than if I gained 8? Do we really know that? And the way to answer that is through study design, as being kind of a big player here. And you have to have control groups. You have to have non-exercise control groups to know what the random error is. So that's something that kind of interests me a lot. Now, one of the things that this doesn't mean our measurements aren't good at detecting. We're very good at detecting changes from baseline, meaning that this person increased muscle size, this group did not. We're very good at that, right? The measurements can detect that. But like I said, can they detect you change 10, I change 9? Are we really different, right? Or if you change 10 and I change 6, are we different? That's where it becomes a little bit hairy. So the reason why it's important is because we have the government puts a lot of money into trying to explain why people respond differently. So when we're doing that, it might be worth mentioning that we don't really know if people are responding differently quite often. So I'm interested in doing a lot of that. And there's a lot of Greg Atkinson has published a lot of stuff on this. I don't know if he's a statistician, but he certainly writes a lot about stats, and him and I think Will Hopkins. So, but you know, it's not intuitive to me. It could be intuitive to you and some of your listeners. My student Scott Dinkle, it's very intuitive to him, and I think he's probably confused most of the time on how it's not intuitive to me. But I get it now. But I think that these individual responders and can we actually detect them? That's one of the things that interests me moving forward.
Man, it's super fascinating, right? Because if you can identify the characteristics of these individual responders, you can isolate them and then potentially influence them, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. And for us, it's one of those things where we're interested in it from the performance standpoint of how can we manipulate to get a little bit bigger, a little bit stronger. Whereas, you know, it also obviously has some clinical ramifications as well.
So, man, I save this for the end on purpose because it makes everybody have to listen to the end. But I want to do the deep dive on blood flow restriction. So
sure.
You're the guy, man. You know, from what I can see, you're the guy who's pioneering all the research, all the protocols. You've studied it more than anybody else that I can see, at least in North America. And I'd love to hear the deep dive on BFR, who should be using it, who shouldn't, how they should be doing it, what they're doing wrong, and what the most important things are to consider. So tell us about what your research found and why blood flow restriction is a useful implement for anyone looking to change their body.
Sure. I appreciate those kind words, and we do a lot of work. There's a lot of other people who do a lot of good work as well. We one of our main focuses at the University of Mississippi is blood flow restriction. One of the things that, you know, I always break it up into kind of three separate phases. The first one we talked about not having a lot of evidence, but there is some indication that people who have just had surgery who can't do anything, that maybe applying blood flow restriction without exercise may actually help you maintain some strength and slow down the loss of muscle mass. And then when you combine it with slow walking or slow cycling or something like that, in some populations, you're able to increase muscle size and strength. Now, I think that's very population specific.
Sure.
I think that if we took you or me or any one of your listeners who are probably pretty active and we go, let's walk at 1.8 miles per hour with blood flow restriction, my guess is you might maintain, but you're not going to be increasing a whole lot of muscle mass.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we talk about changes being similar to that of high load exercise, what we're referring to is blood flow restriction in combination with low load exercise, meaning, you know, 20% and 30%, and we're looking at even lower intensities than that now, or lower loads. But when you do this, you're able to see muscle size similar to that of high load exercise, and you see muscle strength increases, but most of the time is a little bit less than high load exercise, at least in the 1RM. Mm-hmm. You get, you know, isokinetic or isometric, it's usually pretty similar. And again, that goes back to the specificity component. Now, so those are the three kind of domains of which we talk. Now, one of our big focuses always is methodology. And when we first came into this, it was just people were applying random cuffs, random pressures, and it was a big problem because the wider the cuff is, the lower the pressure. Okay, and a high pressure to you might be a high pressure to me might be a low pressure to you. Is a better way to say that, because mm-hmm. a lot of it's dictated by the size of the limb. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that, you know, we in a group from Brazil have really kind of pushed for is making the pressure relative to the arterial occlusion pressure, which is kind of a fancy way of saying that it's basically the systolic pressure of the limb. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people just take blood pressure and then they make it relative to that. And that's not really good unless that's the same cuff that you're using. So the methodology that we use is we primarily use a narrow cuff on the upper body. It doesn't seem to really matter. But what the general premise is, whatever cuff that you use, just make the pressure relative to the cuff and to the person. And the way to do that is, if you were going to train your arms, you put the cuff on and then you would increase the pressure using the cuff that you're going to use up until you cease blood flow. And then you would take a percentage of that. So if your arterial occlusion pressure was 100 millimeters of mercury, we would probably apply 40%, which would be 40 millimeters of mercury. So the premise is that we're restricting blood flow into the limb, but we're not occluding it. So blood flow is still going in. So that's kind of the premise with methodology. Now, who should use this?
So before you go into that, man, like for everybody home who may not have access to a blood pressure cuff, do you have some kind of applicable tidbits that you can say, hey man, apply with this much amount of perceived tension or and the other thing would be location of placement, right? I think that's an important thing to talk about.
Yeah. So the location is, we only apply the cuffs to the top of the arm and to the top of the legs.
So now when you say top of the arm, I see some people doing it like below the deltoid and some people doing it above the deltoid. Does it matter?
Yeah, I would go below. So it's going to cover the top portion of your bicep. Now, obviously, if you're using knee wraps, which is what I've recommended people use for practical blood flow restriction, you don't know the pressure. And for research, that's a big problem. And it could be a problem in training as well. But I think if you apply it with the idea that you're going to restrict blood flow but not completely occlude it, mm-hmm. I think that'll help a lot. So I think that one of the key points to remember is that if you're training at around 30% of your 1RM, as we've shown using fancy equipment, that the higher the pressure, you don't get more adaptation. So if you're getting anywhere between 40 and 90% restriction, or at least arterial occlusion pressure, you're probably going to get similar benefits. So I think that's good because you don't have to, if you get one arm a little bit tighter than the other, it doesn't matter, right? So I think that if you apply the cuff or you apply the wrap, and you should be able to feel some restriction before you exercise. Now, if you are in pain prior to exercise, then the wraps are too tight, right? You need to loosen them up. And if you wrap it and you can check your pulse at your wrist. If you don't have a pulse, that means the wraps are too tight, that you're under arterial occlusion. So I would say as long as you can probably feel your pulse, you're probably fine. Now, one of the things that I would do, I recommend kind of using the repetitions that you get as kind of an index of blood flow restriction, meaning that if you are doing, you know, the kind of the traditional protocol is 30, then three sets of 15. Now, there's nothing special about this protocol at all. If you did three or four sets to failure, it's going to be the same thing, right? But the reason why I use 30, 15, 15, 15 is because it kind of gives you an index of how much restriction is going on. So if you can get 30 reps and then you can get close to 15 in the last three sets, you're probably good. Now, you're not always going to get them, right? And sometimes you might get nine. It's okay, but it's going to give you some indication of how much restriction is occurring. So now we've just finished up a study using kind of practical wraps where we're looking at changes in blood flow, where we're trying to standardize it a little bit differently. And I don't want to talk about it too much because we just, it's not published yet, but controlling the belt length. So if you're going to use like a cuff in the form of kind of like a belt where you can kind of control how tight it gets by pulling on it, that might be a useful way to do it as well. But that'll be coming in the future. But another popular way that people have used is kind of a 7 out of 10. So I'll wrap it with a 7. Personally, I don't feel like that's probably the best practice. I think that checking your pulse and using the amount of repetitions you get is probably going to be a little bit better than using kind of a subjective perception of tightness. Obviously, that's just my opinion. But that's how I would do it. But again, just so the listeners realize that the goal of blood flow restriction is just to reduce blood flow, right? When the goal is not to occlude it. So it's just to reduce it. And go ahead.
Can you talk about the mechanism a little bit so people understand what's actually happening and what we assume is happening?
Yeah, that's a good question. Now, again, just to talk on it as kind of as simply as possible, what we think is that when you restrict blood flow and you contract the muscle, you produce metabolites. Now, during normal exercise, those metabolites are flushed out. During blood flow restriction, we've essentially, especially during the rest period, we've blocked venous return out of the muscle. So all those metabolites that have been produced are being maintained. Now, when you start exercise, we believe that those metabolites might be augmenting activation, meaning that you're able to recruit more muscle fibers to lift the same load. And that's happening because you're basically expediting the fatigue process. Now, I think that there could be something to the cell swelling effect, but to be honest, there's not a lot of strong evidence behind that. But I think that the majority of it is augmenting the mechanical through the accumulation of metabolites. Now, one of the questions is, while there is some evidence, particularly from Yasuda, that if you do bench press exercise with your arms wrapped, that you're able to augment the chest, right? That the chest is able to increase muscle size. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, the chest is not under blood flow restriction. So how is that working? And to be honest, we still have no idea. We are trying to figure that out as well. One of the proposed ideas is that it's kind of the same mechanism, meaning that you're fatiguing the triceps and the chest is having to augment activation to keep lifting the load. That's the hypothesis. Is it true? No idea. But that's one of the ideas that's been put forth, because there is some evidence that even muscles that are proximal to the cuff undergo some adaptation, which is good news because you obviously can't occlude blood flow to the chest.
Right.
You can only occlude the limbs. But there is some evidence that maybe you do see adaptations proximal to the cuff.
So what are the best applications for this, Jeremy, and who should be using it?
Yeah, I think the kind of the way I've described it before is, look, if there's ever a time where you go to the gym maybe one during a deload, right, where you're kind of cutting back on some of the stress, maybe that's a time to use it. Or maybe if you go into the gym and you just don't have it that day mentally. It takes a lot less mental stress to lift a low load than it does lift a high load. So maybe it's safer in that respect. Or maybe you could even program it into your exercise, where maybe you have a low load day with blood flow restriction and a traditional high load day. There's lots of different ways to do it. But I think that people who aren't hurt can use that. But I think that one of the biggest utilities perhaps is if you have an injury and you can't lift heavy weight, this might be a time where you can do blood flow restriction. Obviously, I'm not a physician, so check with your physician, but there is some evidence, and there's a lot of studies going on right now in the clinical setting that show that if a person's injured, that there's a lot of utility to using blood flow restriction, or there at least appears to be. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of probably the big uses for it. People who One of, you know, the other, I guess the other kind of example is, I think Dwight Howard was on ESPN talking about his use of blood flow restriction. One of the things that he uses it for is, obviously when you're playing a professional sport and you're traveling a lot, you have a lot of stress just playing the game. Mm-hmm. So you don't want any additional mechanical stress during your training. So he uses it, because when he was young, it was no problem, but now he's a little bit older. I think he uses it as a tool to still work out, but you use low mechanical loads, and maybe he can recover a little bit better from that. So if you want to, he wants to be able to perform on the court. He doesn't care how he performs at the gym.
Right.
He just wants to be able to perform his best when it actually matters to his paycheck. So I think that's also kind of a utility when you get a little bit older, or and you're playing a professional sport, or you're playing a sport where you need to show up for on the game day, and you don't want to recover from the high mechanical stresses of training. That might be something to consider.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Has there been any research that looks at perhaps what I've seen some people suggest is that actually has benefits in healing existing injuries? Is there any research behind that?
Yeah, I've heard that. To my knowledge, I don't really know that. I haven't seen that. I think that I could see an argument being made because you typically can recover a lot faster. But at the same time, I don't want listeners to think that if you lift high loads, that it takes you a monumental amount of time to recover from that. It doesn't. But maybe blood flow restriction can recover just a little bit faster. So maybe you can train with a little bit higher frequency, and maybe that can do something. But with respect to just having a I'm not sure about that.
Cool, man. So two questions that can kind of be combined as one is, who shouldn't be doing this? And what are some of the biggest errors that people are making?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that one of the things that if you have, this is kind of a catch-22, because I think that for people who aren't under a clinical trial or who don't have physician oversight, you know, one of the things is if you're at risk for a thromboembolism, meaning that if you're at an elevated risk for blood clotting, you probably should be very careful with this. And how do you know if you're at a high risk? You know, there's risk factors. So if you have if you're obese, if you just had surgery, if you have a family history of it, you know, that's probably your biggest, you know, one of your bigger risks. If you're not obese and you haven't had surgery, do you have a lot of this in your family? That might be something to consider. Now, there's no evidence that suggests that it activates those blood clotting cascades, or that blood flow restriction in any way would exacerbate that. But it's just being cautious. Now, some people would point out that that's interesting, because one of the utilities that you just said was during clinical, that it could be very useful in the clinical setting where if you just had surgery, where you have an elevated risk, but that would be under physician oversight. Now, another potential, again, we don't know, but another potential is if you've had kind of lymph nodes removed, maybe you've had breast cancer and they've removed lymph nodes. One of the things that they usually don't let you do is take blood pressure on that side of the body. Now, again, we don't have any evidence for that, but it probably makes sense that if you've had that and they don't want you to take blood pressure on that side, it probably makes sense not to do blood flow restriction either. Just to be careful. So I think those are kind of the big two. I think that what was the second part of the question?
I don't remember, man. Good question. So I think you did a good job answering. The question was, who shouldn't be using it, and what are the things people are doing wrong?
What are the things people are doing wrong? I think that one of them is that the kind of the philosophy of a little bit of restriction is good. A lot of restriction is better. And there's not a lot that's not really the case, especially if you're using a decent, you know, around 20 to 30% of your 1RM. Mm-hmm. The other thing is what I find is that people are just using too heavy of weight. So they'll lift around 50 to 60% and they apply blood flow restriction. But, you know, you're not going to be getting much out of blood flow restriction if you're lifting high loads. The benefit to using blood flow restriction is that you can train with a lightweight. If you're doing 60 to 70% of your 1RM and you add blood flow restriction on top of it, you're not going to be increasing any adaptation out of just doing a high load exercise. I think one of the other things is, and I don't know that it's an effectiveness concern, more so maybe a safety one. One of the things that people do sometimes is if they're doing calf raises, they'll wrap it just above the knee. I don't think that that makes it ineffective. One of my concerns with doing that is there's not a lot of tissue there. So it's very easy to occlude blood flow and very easy to, my guess is probably to put pressure on a nerve there. So I would still recommend just applying them at the top of the leg or the top of the arm. I think you can still get adaptation at the calf by restricting the upper limb.
Okay.
But again, I don't have evidence for that. That's just one of my things where I think, there's just not a lot of tissue there. And it probably makes sense to wrap the restriction where you have a decent amount of meat, especially at the top of the leg. Cool.
So one final question for you, man. If you close your eyes and you have a crystal ball and you say in 10 years, the top athletes in the world are going to be training like this, what does it look like? Like what are the greatest advancements that are going to be made in the next 10 years? And how do you think people are going to be training?
I think that one of the things I think they'll be doing is training less.
I completely agree.
And I think that they'll be training, they'll be spending less time in the gym, and they'll be spending more time recovering. Mm-hmm. I think that my lab's kind of working hypothesis is that people should spend more time training at what they're actually going to be doing. So if you're going to be that's why, you know, the specificity thing, you're going to be a powerlifter, you should be spending a lot of time lifting like that. If you're going to be playing football and you're a wide receiver, I don't know how much you're really getting out of a lot of those lifts. Now, I do think that there is some utility to lifting weights, especially with perhaps injury prevention, but that lifting weights looks a lot different than how people think lifting weights is. Mm-hmm. So I think that people will be spending more time practicing their actual sport. They'll be spending some time in the gym, but less time, and they'll be spending more time recovering.
Yeah, I think that, to extend my opinion on that question is stress, man. Like, training is a stress, life is a stress, psychological stresses. People don't use enough stress management techniques to be able to grow. You know, like, if you want to be successful in any sport, whether it be strongman or professional athletics or bodybuilding, your biggest necessity is stress management. That includes recovery from those hard workouts. And you have to have, you know, everything in your bag of tricks and throwing it all at your recovery. Yeah, and that's why my, you know, latest progression of my life has been toward that and teaching people how to, you know, control and start to manage their mental stress. Because, you know, throughout my career, that was my biggest advantage and my biggest curse was I was aware of it. But, you know, in the beginning, I didn't know how to control it. So, you know, learning techniques and strategies to optimize recovery and mental stress is massive. Because, as you know, man, if you're psychologically stressed out, the likelihood of getting the same amplitude of response is substantially diminished.
Yeah, I agree.
Jeremy, man, I think you're doing awesome stuff. Is there anything else you want to give, anyone you want to give a shout out to, or anything else you want to, mention where people can reach you?
Yeah, I mean, you can follow me on Twitter. That's probably where I communicate the most, at JP Lennecke. So JPLOENNEKE. Mm-hmm. It's the same tag on Instagram. I think that one of the things I always like to point out is that I'm lucky in the sense that I get to speak a lot for my lab, and we've done a lot of good things, but I never want to give the impression that all these ideas are just solely mine, that I've done all this on my own, I have no help, that I just sit back and write these papers. It's nonsense.
Right.
So, my students play a pivotal role in this, and, my students, including Sam Buckner, Scott Dinkle, Kevin Maddox, Matt Jesse, Grant Mauser, and Zach Bell. I mean, those guys, they work hard. I mean, every day, all day. So I think that they've been played a pivotal role in just kind of sitting around discussing these ideas and trying to get at what's actually happening. So I think that give them a shout out and I think that we're all working pretty hard at the University of Mississippi.
Awesome. Jeremy, well, thank you so much for being a great leader, man, and empowering those young men to obviously change the world just like you are, man, because you're definitely the driving force in the great research that's coming out of University of Mississippi. So thank you so much, man. I appreciate your time. I know you're a busy man. I'll let you get back to work.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy. Have a great day, man. Hey, I hope you enjoyed that podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Head on over to iTunes right now and leave me a review. Let me know if you loved it. Let me know if you absolutely hated it. Either way, I need to know so I can improve my job and bring you guys the best information with respect to muscle building, health optimization, and building a better person, building a better man. So thank you very much to our sponsors, which make this stuff possible. I'd love for you guys to each head over and check out atplab.com, ATP Labs, or ATP Lab. Either one works. ATP is a company I've recently aligned with because they have world-class manufacturing, and everything they do is third-party tested and proven to be what it is inside the bottle that it says it is on the label. And you guys know that's massive. And not only that, we're getting the best quality ingredients from anywhere in the world that provides them. Thank you also to Prime Fitness USA, the best equipment for someone looking to build muscle and make the most of their time. I chose to reach out to Prime personally. They never reached out to me. I reached out to them because I knew what they had, and I really believed in their product, and I brought every one of their pieces into my gym, and we still use them every day because, you know, we're all about mindful attention to detail. We are muscle intelligence. We are the ones teaching the best people in the world, the smartest people in the world, how to build muscle in the least amount of time. Another shout out to Gasp and Better Bodies for always taking great care of myself and my trainers and my staff. If you guys want to get a discount for Gasp Better Bodies, head over to bempikolsky.com/podcasts and check out the show notes from this show and all the other shows, and you can find transcripts there as well. So have a wonderful day. Upgrade your life, stay focused, and live a life of greatness.